Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federalist Society virtual event. My name is Sarah Clark, and I'm Assistant Director of Practice Groups with the Federalist Society. Today, we're excited to host this FedSoc Forum called Regulation and Fair Access to Banking. We're very pleased to welcome an excellent group of panelists. John Berlau is a Senior Fellow and Director of Finance Policy at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. He is also the author of the book George Washington, Entrepreneur, How Our Founding Fathers' Business Pursuits Changed America and the World. Tabitha Edgens is Executive Vice President and Co-Head of Regulatory Affairs for the Bank Policy Institute. Brian Knight serves as Senior Counsel on the Corporate Engagement Team at Alliance Defending Freedom. Our moderator, John Holtman, is the Washington Bureau Chief for American Banker. If you'd like to learn more about today's moderator or speakers, her full bios can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. Throughout the program, we'll turn to our audience for questions. If you have a question, please enter into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window, and we'll do our best to answer as many as we can. Finally, I will note, as always, all expressions of opinion today are those of our guest speakers, not the Federalist Society. With that, Mr. Holtman, thank you so much for joining us tonight, and I'll hand things over to you.
Thank you, Sarah, and thank you, everyone, for joining us today. So we're talking about debanking, right? And I just want to start out by talking about what exactly it is we're talking about. So, Brian, what is debanking?
Thanks, John. So debanking, when people talk about debanking, they tend to talk about one of three things, and this is a Venn diagram with overlap. One would be a federal or state regulator who regulates banks, putting inappropriate pressure on a bank or other financial institution to cut ties with a customer. And the sort of paradigmatic example of this is the FDIC pressuring banks to cut off payday or refund anticipation loans. This is often what's referred to as Operation Choke Point 1.0. The second scenario is where perhaps regulation inadvertently renders customers just economically unviable. Something like, say, the obligations to comply with the Bank Secrecy Act raises the cost or risk too much. So even though there's nothing wrong with the customer, banks feel compelled to cut people off. The third and perhaps most controversial bucket is banks themselves deciding, well, we will not bank certain customers to try to affect the downstream world. Maybe that motivation is coming from the bank's management. Maybe it's coming from some constituency of the bank, like other customers or employees. And examples of this include the targeting of firearms manufacturers, contractors who assisted U.S. immigration, and fossil fuels, where you see banks saying, well, look, we want to be part of the change. We want to drive change to a better place. And so we are going to curtail access to financial services to do that.
Tabitha, can you tell us a little bit about, like, to the extent that we know the sort of what is the problem in the administration's view that and the banking industry's view that we're trying to solve here?
Yeah. So when I think about, what the problem is that we're trying to solve, I think the best place to start is the president's August executive order on guaranteeing fair access to financial services. And there it states that the concern is with politicized or unlawful debanking, which it defines sort of, I'm paraphrasing here a little bit, as restricting access to financial services based on a customer's political or religious beliefs or based on lawful business activities that the provider disagrees with for political reasons. The industry supports fair access to banking, and I think there's broad agreement that political and religious beliefs should not unfairly affect customers' access to banking services. So that's why we've been working with Congress and the administration to address the root causes, many of which Brian just described in his second bucket, which are those regulatory causes, to ensure that banks can continue to serve law-abiding customers. As far as that that middle bucket, like Brian was saying, with the regulatory drivers, I do think it's important to note that while debanking can mean a lot of different things to different people, like Brian was saying, at the core of the issue, I think, is that consumers are having their accounts closed when they are law abiding and creditworthy. And they don't know why. So I think we want to get into, and there's probably, we'll talk about it more in depth in this panel, but given that it's called regulation and fair access to banking, we'll talk about those regulatory contributors to the issue. That includes the BSA framework, like Brian was saying, which tasks banks with rooting out financial crimes and fraud, and threatens, severe penalties if they slip up. But it also includes, beyond BSA AML, guidance that we've seen over the years, including on crypto, on climate, on reputation risk, all of which we'll get into, and all of which have circumscribed banks' abilities to make business decisions. So we're happy to see a lot of those that have been changed. But that's some of the key drivers and areas for focus to address the issue.
And John, if I might,
please.
So Tabitha has an excellent description of bucket two. Bucket three is, like I said, the most controversial. And I think one thing that's worth noting about the EO and what we've been seeing from this administration and what we've seen at the state level is that there's also a recognition that banks receive a ton of government protection. They receive a ton of government power, and they are given that for the purpose of facilitating a lawful economy. But if you have banks, especially large banks, like as we saw in 2019, 2020, and before, saying, well, look, we're going to use our privileged position to try to frustrate the lawful economy because we don't think this should be available or it should be lawful, then that's antithetical to the reason why that power and protection is given. And this administration is saying, well, look, we do not want to see this power abused. And so that's another part of what we're seeing, from the regulators as they're doing their examinations. The OCC just had their preliminary report come out. And also what we're seeing at the state level as states are passing fair access laws aimed at that third bucket.
Getting a little ahead of ourselves there, Brian, but we'll flesh that out some more for sure. But this is something I want to tease up another question that I think is very important, which is, what do we know about the scope of this thing? I mean, there's a lot of anecdotal examples of people saying they got debanked, but what do we really know about how much of this, like how often this happens, when it happens, and how much of it can be ascribed to, malfeasance versus just kind of like a run of the mill, business decision? I'm going to throw that to John Berlow then.
Yes, John, pleasure to be here with my fellow distinguished panelists and at this FedSoc forum. Thanks, everybody, for attending. We know quite a bit, particularly about the government's role, but we don't know enough. Operation Choke Point in the Obama administration, which my organization, the Competitive Enterprise Institute, has been exposing and fighting against since 2014, were not just payday loans. They were a part of it. There were dozens of businesses that groups from the CFPB to the FDIC to the Department of Justice under Obama were saying, these are high risk, putting pressure on banks not to serve everything, as I've said, from firearms to fireworks. Pornography made it, and then you had things like the climate guidance under the Biden administration, where they said be careful of climate risk. The FDIC and the Fed and OCC did a coordinated guidance on this, which I believe believe has since been repealed. You also had the FDIC revealed in February of last year, 25 pause letters to banks asking, to 24 banks asking to deal with digital assets. So the government's role has been quite extensive. Many people have been debanked as a result, and you need even more investigations. We need like a Twitter file showing with the deplatforming about how much the government in some of the high profile cases, was there a suspicious activity report? Was there a reputational risk guidance, either formally or informally, from the bank examiner? I am glad, and there is a lot to praise in the President Trump's executive order about ending reputational risk. But we need to go further as far as the Bank Secrecy Act, the suspicious activity reports, as which is, you know, BPI had noted. I mean, can be they're filed on many innocent Americans, yet the bank regulators will and sometimes have justified that as saying, well, we need all the information in case there's a terrorist or a criminal, which is raises some First Amendment concerns. But then there's also encouragement, even though everyone knows that most people they're filed on are completely innocent, that, you know, banks should, you know, close the accounts of the other person. I've read that BPI has written about that. I've also talked to some in the field. So I would on bucket one and bucket two, as Brian mentioned, I'm in almost complete agreement. It's bucket three. I do think it's going far and raises freedom of association questions when you say a bank has to respect, has to deal with everyone who and cannot not deal with disassociate based on the First Amendment grounds. I mean, you look at some of the horrible comments about Charlie Kirk, some private businesses when, you know, people were saying awful things like, I hope the bullet didn't get hurt, other things. Those people who made those comments got fired. And then, in my opinion, they should have been fired by everyone from DC Comics to MSNBC. I think a bank also, or a credit union, also has a right to say, this speech is, among other things, creating a risk. We don't have to deal with this person.
So, John, if I might, because John Berlow raised the issue of freedom of association, and I would say I don't think that's actually accurate as a matter of law. Freedom of association is related to the right to free speech. And for that to apply, you know, the issue has to be that if, you know, the association with the person will interfere with the speaker's ability to speak. And so in a scenario where we're talking about bank products, those are not expressive acts. And so the scenario here, as the 11th Circuit recently wrote in the Fearless Fund case, where you had a venture fund that said, we're only going to invest in minority businesses. And they were sued for racial discrimination. And one of Fearless Fund's defenses is, well, look, we're trying to make a statement about the state of the economy for minorities. And what the court correctly pointed out based on a lot of Supreme Court precedent is, there's a difference between making an expressive act versus just refusing to do business with certain groups to try to make a statement. And, you know, some of our leading free speech cases, which I'm proud to say my colleagues have been responsible for, they deal with the fact that, like, you cannot make an artist create art, or, you know, speak or create a statement that they disagree with. That's different from saying, oh, you're not allowed to require people to do general business with people, or that someone has a right to say, full stop, I will not do business with somebody because of some protected criteria. Now, we should note that in many cases, particularly on the industry side, until recently, there really weren't legal protections. There wasn't really a protected class. That is starting to change. But there is not a First Amendment issue here with prohibiting banks from refusing traditional banking services on the basis of sort of industry criteria. And I will say that fair access laws do not imply a duty to serve. They, like traditional anti-discrimination law, instead remove a criteria upon which a bank might make a decision because that criteria is inappropriate or creates undue harm to society. And I would love to get into the history of that, because there's actually a rich history of us doing this in the banking system.
We will get to that. I did have one thing I wanted to ping Tabitha on, which is teed up on something John said, which is We need like a Twitter files of this. We need like a dump of like what's behind the curtain. But can you tell us a little bit about like, are these kind of debanking actions tracked internally by banks? Are they tracked by supervisors? Is what data that is tracked comparable from one institution to another? Like what is the universe of what is knowable about how often and under what circumstances debanking occurs?
Yes, so not to my knowledge, John. I don't think there's been a sort of systematic tracking, certainly by regulators previously. They, of course, have complaint databases where high level mm-hmm. information about complaints is available. But again, I'm not aware of formal tracking, that goes into the specifics of these types of complaints. So I think we don't know very much about the scale of the issue or even, sort of confirmed facts about individual cases. I will say, reviews by the agencies pursuant to the president's executive order are ongoing. And, the OCC has said that they plan to share additional information in due course coming out of that. So we may learn more. I will say, again, it's, commercial information that I'm not aware of, as far as the scale and numbers. My understanding is that, the percentage of accounts that are closed each year is small. It's typically done to ensure, again, compliance with both financial crime regulations, as well as to stop or prevent fraud. Overall, it is a small fraction of accounts that are closed. Per a recent FDIC survey, overall 96% of American households have bank accounts. So that's the highest number that the FDIC has recorded since they've started, tracking American access to bank accounts. So there's certainly more work to do, but just want to, I think it is trending well and that access to financial services, fortunately, is increasing. And, we're committed to increasing it further.
I mean, in a follow-on question there is, to what extent is the rules around confidential supervisory information, to what extent does that complicate our ability to see into this and arguably other kinds of internal bank phenomenon? I can throw that to you, Tabitha. I can also open it up to anyone else.
Sure. I'm happy to jump in, but I am interested in John and Brian's views as well. I mean, I think there's no doubt that CSI, so confidential supervisory information for folks on the line, which is essentially the agencies have interpreted to mean any information that is provided or conveyed to an institution as part of the bank examination process is bank agency property, and that institutions and individuals can be subject to criminal penalties for disclosing any of that information. There are good historical reasons that we have confidentiality around bank supervision. But again, the way it's been interpreted and enforced this broadly can really have a chilling effect on our ability to understand the supervisory process. So a lot of what happens in supervision is behind the scenes. You may see one thing that's written in regulation or guidance documents, but you may have many interactions directly with your agency and supervision team that isn't publicly available, and you're prohibited from making it available. So one example, I think we referenced earlier, John referenced the FDIC letters that were published earlier this year or earlier last year. In January, I think it was late January, sort of showing, giving a really rare peek, I think, behind the curtain of that process, showing sort of extensive back and forth between FDIC examiners and banks that were seeking to, engage in activities involving crypto assets. And you can see through those letters, what becomes clear is that there's not a formal prohibition, but what there is a very burdensome and extensive back and forth of phone calls and information requests and asks for analysis and justification for, why a bank is engaging in a certain business or, providing services to a specific customer. So again, all of that is not available to the public and those of us on the outside to see, but those FDIC letters are an interesting peek behind the curtain.
And John, if I might, Tabitha it raises excellent points. And I think the issue of opacity or lack of transparency is even broader than that, right? So you have sort of the bucket one regulator leaning on the bank scenario, you have the confidential supervisory information bar to transparency. In bucket two, the sort of regulatory cost issue, certainly with things like the Bank Secrecy Act, there are very strong legal prohibitions on sharing information with the potential subject of a suspicious activity report. And then in bucket three, if the bank isn't putting out a press release announcing their policy, which some of them did in certain areas, it's also worth knowing that, particularly if you're an industrial customer, a commercial customer, not an individual, you have no real means of information forcing against a bank, right? You can't just go to the bank and say, give me the real reason. That if applicable, they'll file a Reg B notice, which is pretty sparse, but the bank can just kind of stonewall you in most cases. And so all three sort of buckets of debanking are operating or have been operating in a very opaque environment. And so therefore, when people say, oh, well, there's no evidence of this, one, that's incorrect just based on the definition of evidence. But to the extent they're like, well, there's not a lot of smoke here, it's part of what's going on, potentially at least, is that this is an environment that is designed by law and by, just the way things have developed to prevent smoke from being seen. And you need, part of what we're getting at, hopefully going to get out of this executive order, are the regulators providing more transparency, both upon, the agency's past actions, but also the actions of the financial institutions themselves?
I'd say, John, I'd be in complete agreement. The secrecy needs to end. People need to be, there's no reason in it. If anything, the regulators, there might be a reason for the regulators to keep the investigation in confidence. But if the banks want to reveal, they should be able, and or credit unions, they should certainly be able to be forthcoming with a customer like that. Some of the law enforcement justification is, well, this will tip off potential criminals. Chances are, if they're potential criminals, they're already going to be tipped off by the bank account closing itself. So there's really no, it's one thing, while they're under investigation, but if the account is going to be closed and say maybe a small 0.05% exception, but banks should be able to talk about and give the reason why as far as that goes. And then that way, if there is a process in court or other things, and then people will have the information.
I want to put a pin in that, because we'll get to that a little later. One question, we sort of touched on this a little bit already, but like what has the administration done so far in the first year? What concrete steps have happened to address this? I guess since John, you were just talking, I'll just start right there with you.
Well, they've done a lot of good things as far as the FDIC release was, which was in the beginning of the administration, of what past agencies have done, of showing the wrongs there, I think, and the ending of as per the EO, and even before that, the ending of reputational risk, as far as the agencies using that as a risk criterion, that is going to be that itself. It should be codified by Congress, and there are bills. Particularly Senator Tillis's bill and Senator, which has some fair access mandates I disagree with, but also the FIRM Act that passed the Senate Banking Committee of Senator Scott that codify the ending of reputational risk. So that as far as pressure, regulators cannot put pressure on to debank a certain or to target a certain industry is going to be very, very important. So that's the commendable action from the administration, and also bills in Congress.
And I would add to that another thing that the FDIC and the OCC is doing, and it would be wonderful if the Federal Reserve would follow suit in terms of doing this via regulation, is they're also actually trying to put a definition around unsafe and unsound practice. Because for a long time, unsafe and unsound practice was basically as broad as the regulator could get away with. And different courts had interpreted it at different levels of restriction. So, and of course, like the reason that a regulator is supposed to be able to sort of, interfere with the bank's conduct is to protect the safety and soundness of the bank, or to protect, the customer in the case of like a consumer protection issue. And so, part of why reputation risk started is the idea of like, oh, well, if it hurts your reputation, maybe people will stop doing business with you, and then that will hurt your financial position, and that makes you vulnerable to failure, and that's unsafe and unsound. And so, both the FDIC and the OCC are trying via regulation to define what an unsafe and unsound practice is, and that will help bind the examiner and will provide more predictability to the banks about like, okay, well, where is that line where the regulator may have a legitimate, interest versus what is just sort of our general course of business?
Yeah, and can I jump in on that too, Brian? Because that's such an important point on the safety and unsafe and unsound and MRA proposal. It's the key sort of reform in that proposal is that the agencies are for the first time, they're adopting a proposed definition of this term that is, a huge behemoth in banking regulation. And they're tying it to financial risks, consistent with the case law that has defined what unsafe or unsound practices are. So by tying it to actual financial risks, so bank risks to a bank's capital or its liquidity, credit risk, et cetera, by tying it to those financial risks, it's eliminating so much of that subjectivity in the supervision process, kind of like as we were talking about before, where sometimes you can have situations where the conversation is really about business judgment and whether this is the right way to be running your business rather than monitoring true risks to the financial condition of the firm. So agree with Brian that that's a huge reform that, among other things, will empower institutions to make business judgments that will better serve their customers and the economy.
I think we sort of touched this a little bit, but
if you're a bank right now and what's the legal restrictions or rules of the road around your accepting or debanking? Like if you have what are the rules and law around your taking a customer and parting ways with a customer? I guess I'll send that to you, Brian.
Yeah. So at the federal level, there's actually surprisingly little. You have the Equal Credit Opportunity Act and, you have civil rights law around mortgages and some other financial institutions, but at least or financial products. But to my knowledge, there isn't something governing payments or deposits. And those have a certain set of protected classes. And they say, in effect, you cannot make a decision based upon the fact that the customer fits within one of these protected classes. Now, there's also the disparate impact question of, well, if you make a decision, it disproportionately affects people of a certain, protected class, that might also give rise to liability. That's controversial, but the discriminatory intent portion, that is pretty well established and pretty well accepted. There are, prior to the past few years, there were some states that had broader protections. They would protect classes that were not protected under federal law, things like political affiliation or sexual orientation. And in the recent couple of years, since about 2019, where we saw certain banks be very, very vocal about their decision to debank industries with the desire to drive societal change, you have had states that have passed laws prohibiting banks from making or denying services on the basis of a desire to interfere with lawful activity or to try to prevent people from engaging in lawful activity. You also have laws that protect political affiliation, political activity. Because, the laws that protected political affiliation were, are you a Republican or are you a Democrat? Versus, you are advocating for this bill or advocating for or against this cause. You're trying to influence society. So these new crop of fair access laws actually get to that. That's there to help protect people from banks, purely, at least many of the laws apply only to relatively large banks, abusing their privileged position to try to dictate rather than facilitate the economy.
That brings me to
like one of the things in the executive order, it refers to political debanking, right? Mm-hmm. And of course, like political affiliation is there's a certain number of federally protected classes, and it's like age, race, national origin, so on and so forth. But political affiliation isn't one of them. Does that complicate things at all now that there's an executive order saying you can't do political debanking, but legally that is that's something that banks are allowed to do? Tabitha, do you want to touch that?
Yeah, I mean, I think, I agree that, political affiliation hasn't been covered in, ACOA or existing, statutory law. But, I also agree kind of, as we were saying at the outset, that, banks make decisions based on business and commercial risks and not based on, political and certainly, religious factors, which are already, covered by ACOA as described. I think that, banks are, all that said, banks do have extensive expectations for, how they make business decisions. In general, the agencies have always sort of said that, that banks decide the level of risk that they are to assume and that whether they decide to extend services to a particular customer, as long as they're within the parameters of the law, then that's a bank business decision. I think in many ways that's been an aspiration rather than, entirely true in practice. Mainly because of that sort of regulatory and supervisory environment that we've been talking about. Again, the BSA AML framework is a big piece of this because it, again, requires banks to dedicate enormous resources to prevent, malicious actors rightfully from using the financial system, but at the same time holds banks to sort of a zero defect standard to prevent financial crimes. So I'm not sure if that's totally answering your question, John, but those are a few of the restrictions that come to mind as we're thinking about how banks make decisions.
John, I think the reason there haven't been laws really until at the federal level about this is the same reason there aren't laws about other businesses, about who they may accept as customers. I mean, there are disagreements among the conservatives and libertarians about whether porn itself should be legal adult entertainment. But I don't think any conservative or libertarian would say that a shopkeeper must carry Playboy or Penthouse or DVD. Yet here with some of either these four access mandates in the EO or through laws like the Tillis bill and others that are even worse, you would have a bank in a position where it would say, it would have to fund if say the adult entertainment industry came for a loan or would have to give a good business reason not to, that, would be an additional layer of red tape that in the Tillis bill, a blue state attorney general could come and challenge. And it's just in general that the First Amendment, you have the First Amendment, the government can't interfere with the First Amendment. But as in the case like of the comments about Charlie Kirk, as in the case of, whether you want to sell pornography or getting rid of the choices, whether you want to finance industries like marijuana, which I agree should be legal and they should. I'm glad that this rescheduling will give legal clarity to banks to do it. But I don't think banks should be forced to really enter relationships into businesses with individuals any more than other businesses are, and other businesses may receive subsidies too, like PPP loans.
So if I might,
you may.
It's a fun story, but actually the reason why political affiliation wasn't covered in ECOA, in the original ECOA amendments, political affiliation was going to be included. But in the hearings, the American Bankers Association and all of the banks came out and said, yeah, it would be terrible if banks discriminated on the basis of political affiliation, but nobody does it. That would be insane for us to do. Why would we do it? And so the reason is not that people didn't think about it or didn't worry about it. It's that the bank said, well, that would be crazy. And I would note that, that also saw a scenario where part of the reason why religion and national origin are covered under ECOA is because of a concern that the banking system was going to be used for political purposes. Specifically, Arab states were trying to incentivize banks to cut off Israeli and Jewish customers. And they weren't relying on banks being anti-Semitic. They were trying to make it make economic sense, right? We have a lot of money. We have a lot of business. If you want our business, you have to cut those folks off over there. And our response as a country was to say, No, we're not going to allow our system to be abused in that way. And so not only did that protect Israeli and Jewish customers, but it also protected the banks, because the bank could turn around to the Arab state and say, look, I can't do that, but neither can anyone else. So it's not a threat anymore. You can't threaten to take your business away from me and go across the street. They're under the same obligation I am. So either leave the American banking system or quit pestering me about it. Spoiler, they quit pestering. And I would also just reaffirm here that when we're talking about deposits, we're talking about loans, we're talking about payment services, which are the things that are generally covered in fair access bills, these are not expressive activities. The First Amendment is not applicable here. I would also note, unlike certain other corporate First Amendment related cases or other corporate religion cases or whatnot, banks receive not only subsidies, but they receive unique power that's granted and discretionarily by the government. They receive protection from failure. They receive everyone might receive some sort of subsidy. It's a mixed economy, but wherever you want to draw the spectrum, banks are to one side of it by a long shot. And the other thing I would note is at least the state bills that we've been involved in and the Tillis bill, which aims at very large institutions, those are all public companies. And so even if you want to grant that, that maybe there is some speech interest or something like that, you have to resolve whose speech. And what we're talking about here are not the shareholders. The banks have no way of knowing what their shareholders want. What we're talking about is the managers and the managers expressing their preferences. And that looks a lot different because the manager is using other people, in this scenario, is using other people's property to forward their preferences. Or in the case like what I discussed in the 1970s, where it's some other constituency trying to pressure the manager, you still have the scenario where other people's property is being used to facilitate someone's preferences or someone's desires, and instead of the person using their own property. So while I don't think that in and of itself would resolve the issue, in favor of not, having a fair access issue, what we're talking about in the real world here is that, all of those arguments are unavailing.
Can I jump in quickly just to sorry.
Tabitha, it's you.
That was a lot to unpack, and I would just say that first of all, that the only apply to small banks, the Tillis bill that might be only apply to large banks, the Tillis bill that might be the case, but the Kramer bill, Senator Kramer's bill mentioned that applies to banks of, 10 billion in assets or larger, that would include like banks like Glacier Bank in Kalispell, Montana, some banks in Arkansas, 10 billion in some of these things that apply to aren't really that large as far as when you compare would hit regional banks in different cities compared to some of the mega banks, which can be a trillion in assets. But even in that case, there is a way. Justice Alito in the Hobby Lobby case, was saying you can do what, a large company, you can divine what shareholders want. You'll bring it to a vote if necessary. You buy stock. I would encourage shareholders to participate. So we can't have like a cutoff with banks or other things where say that their rights to associate or disassociate don't count. I'm not necessarily making a constitutional argument for all these issues. I'm saying, how do we want to live in a free society with a marketplace of ideas where we have the maximum amount of permissiveness? And I'm saying if this is generally we've had it where, if you don't want to partake in, selling porn, you don't have to. If you don't want to partake in financing thing, you don't have to. You can use freedom of conscience. I think that should apply to banks and credit unions as well. And there shouldn't be a special distinction between them and other businesses.
Well, but there is a special distinction, John.
Hold on, Brian. Yes, sir. I'm gonna let Tabitha jump in here.
Yeah, I just want a couple of things because I think both John and Brian are making really important points. I think that, I don't come at this really from I very much respect John's First Amendment expertise and considerations there. I mean, I think as well as, Brian's concerns about access to financial services and, not unfairly discriminating against people for political and religious views, right? So, I mean, I think from my perspective, the harder sort of line drawing exercise as we start to think about what a workable federal fair access standard looks like is, you know, how we ensure that institutions can make business decisions that, you know, work for the business, that work for their risk management, that work for their legal compliance, and understanding that, you know, every institution isn't going to be equipped to service every customer that walks in the door. And there are many, you know, sort of risk management considerations that go into that. So while we can, you know, recognize that, you know, we share the goal of, you know, promoting access to financial services, and again, you know, not discriminating on those political and religious grounds, you know, how do we craft the right standard that's going to let institutions, you know, that don't specialize in a particular industry, make sure that they are not, you know, required to stand up a business to, you know, out of concerns that they're going to be, you know, penalized for not servicing it.
And so I would say, yeah, so one, you know, there, banks are unique. They receive unique powers and for a specific purpose. When they fail or are in danger of failing, we very frequently bail them out, right? The Fed serves as lender of last resort. When Silicon Valley Bank failed, we pressed the 13-3 button to bail out, you know, regional banks. During the crisis, we bailed out some of the very large banks. Why? Well, one, because we need banks to facilitate a lawful economy, and two, out of concern for collateral damage. So to be a bank is not the same as being a bookstore on a host of different levels. And it's not unreasonable for us as a society, if we so choose, to say, hey, we gave you this power. We don't want it turned against us. The other thing I'd say to Tabitha's point is I think she's exactly right. I think we all agree that, you know, not, or at least I don't think anyone on this call wants a duty to serve, right? This notion of, you know, turn banks to a public utility where thou must serve all without price discrimination. And if you have no idea how to underwrite this, well, tough luck. Nobody wants that. And I think that if you look at the Tillis bill, which, you know, we had the pleasure of talking to his office about, and if you look at, you know, at least the bills that you know, ADF has been involved in at the state level, you know, we agree that there are legitimate business reasons, completely legitimate business reasons, for a bank to not take on a customer. What we want to avoid is the abuse of power, either by the bank or by some other constituency trying to use the bank as a lever. And so, you know, if you're looking at risk, like economic risk, if you're, you know, sort of down, if the bank is sort of taking risk instead of trying to make it, that's, we think that's appropriate. With the one exception, though, of, you know, is if the risk is that the bank might face a boycott or some other pressure from some third party who's trying to attack the potential customer in question, that is not legitimate, just like it wasn't legitimate when the Arab states tried to pressure banks against Israeli and Jewish businesses in the 1970s, just like, you know, the Woolworth lunch counter manager could not make a defense saying, well, you know, I'm not racist, but my customers are. That is different because we want to, that's the abuse we want to try to prevent. But otherwise, I completely take Tabitha's point and agree that, like, this is something that needs to be worked out with fear and trembling. We need to allow banks to make economically rational, profitable, sensible choices. And that's another reason why we have supported a large asset cap, because, you know, when you hit that, when you're one of the very largest banks, your capacity to do more is higher. It doesn't mean that you can or will or should do everything, but your capacity to do more is higher than, you know, certainly if you're a smaller bank. And we respect that, and we think that's important.
Well, it seems that we have worked up ahead of steam going into the Q&A section, and that's just what we were hoping to do. So I will, I'll start it off with my question, which is a lot of the focus from the administration to date has been on addressing, I think, as Brian coined it, like kind of the second bucket, which is kind of regulators, or I guess the first and or second bucket, which is regulators kind of like either directly explicitly saying don't do business with this kind of company, or just sort of creating the regulatory conditions that make banks sort of, you know, draw their own conclusions about what kind of businesses to be in business with. But I guess the question is, like, is that the bigger issue, or should it be the bigger issue? And to what extent is the focus on what bank, like on choices that banks are making, individual business decisions that banks are making,
I'll send that to you, I guess, Tabitha.
So, yeah, I mean, from my perspective, yes, I think that's the largest bucket anecdotally is the bucket of accounts that are closed for regulatory reasons. And again, a lot of that really is around the BSA AML framework, which I don't think we talked about yet, the sort of the necessary reforms in detail as we were going through, you know, things that the administration has done so far. You know, the Treasury Secretary has indicated interest in reconsidering the, you know, how we do BSA AML compliance. We already have a 2020 law called the AML Act that directed the agencies to tell banks that they are allowed to direct more resources to higher risk activities that are more likely to catch the traffickers, catch the terrorists, you know, catch the bad guys rather than low risk activities, people who are, you know, likely to just be engaging in you know, ordinary course activities that may set off various triggers. So all that needs to happen is that agencies need to faithfully implement that law that was already passed and allow specifically institutions to direct more resources to those higher risk activities. And that will help to reduce the amount of sort of false positives that you often get in the current framework.
I think something important to all three buckets, and that is very important, is also the administration's focus from Mickey Bowman at the Fed to Travis Hill at the FDIC to Comptroller Gould on clearing barriers to new banks opening, that the de novo bank, which I've testified on, which there used to be pre-2010 about 100 banks opening per year, even when there were banking crises like the SNL. But since 2010, there have been, early to 2025, just 86 for those entire 15 years, less there was than there was in 1 year. And that is starving the banking system of competition and the variety, I mean, to serve new industries, to have the expertise in new industries. And that, because there's a focus that needs to be brought back, that's going to be, you know, very important in making the banking system more competitive and serving a variety of customers.
So I'm all for more banks. I think that would be wonderful. But realistically, depending on how you slice it, the top 10 banks in the United States have just over half of the assets. And so, you know, by all means, let 1,000 flowers bloom. But we also need to keep in mind that the economics of banking, the public policy of banking does tend to drive things to concentration. There are economies of scale. There are scenarios, particularly for industrial customers, where a small bank may not be able to serve you because to give you a loan of the size you need, that would require the bank to become over-concentrated, which is a safety and soundness concern. And so by all means, let's have more banks. And by all means, let's have BSA reform. I think that would be wonderful and important. But, you know, let's just be realistic about some of the drivers and some of the potential solutions.
We got a question here about the National Security Directive regarding anti-American beliefs, sometimes known as the Antifa EO. How does this complicate things, or how does this play into this landscape? How about Brian? You just talked, so you can jump right in there.
Okay, so, you know, obviously, we would need to know more about how it actually plays out. If you look at the actual text of that, it directs the Treasury to basically do what the law is set up to have it do, which is to, you know, to the extent the law allows, work with financial institutions to detect, you know, basically people engaged in or supporting illegal activity, in this case, violent terrorism. So is there a possibility of, you know, a complication or something like that? Sure. But, you know, just taken on its terms, it doesn't look like bucket one, right? But bucket one regulatory abuse is all about, yeah, they're legal, you know, but I, the regulator, don't like them and you shouldn't be dealing with them. And it isn't bucket three, where the banks themselves or some other constituency of the bank is pushing it. You know, it's always possible there might be some sort of bucket two effect, depending on how it's implemented, but we would need more information to see.
I would agree with Brian.
Go ahead,
Sean. I would agree with Brian there. This is clear, we were talking about activities that, you know, debanking, targeting activities that are legal. These are activities that are clearly illegal, although there might be some aspects of the order that may not may need to be looked at more. This is directed at illegal activities. And also, I think the fact that the order is out in the open, it's not sort of done in secret like a choke point where bank regulators were targeting, sort of whispering in the bank's ear and, you know, not making this public or suspicious activity reports, other things. So the fact that it's out in the open and targeting illegal activities makes it just sort of completely sort of different topic than what we're covering here.
Since we're coming a little short on time, I'm going to try to wrap like two or three different questions into one question. So everybody buckle up. We're going to see how this goes. So we talked a little bit about, the fair access bills, some of the regulatory actions around reputational risk. My question is kind of like, what is the lowest hanging fruit, the like kind of most consensus based either regulatory or legal changes that you think are out there in this area that could potentially gain like broad kind of bipartisan stakeholder support? Tabitha, why don't you go first?
I mean, I think if we're talking about, you know, there has been, some legislation on the Hill that's gotten bipartisan support. I'm not the right person to sort of do the political prognosticating about what's most likely to pass or to prevail. I mean, I do think, as evidence through this, in this discussion today, there is, there is a draft legislative text out there on fair access that, provides a good starting point, recognizing the various, trade-offs between, business decision and risk management that we've been discussing. So, that is out there, and there is a lot of, focus, I think, on the Hill is my understanding, and bipartisan support for some of these, legislative proposals, including to provide more transparency and or in the supervision process as well.
Brian, how about you?
Yeah, so, I mean, if it was this panel was our standard, then I think it'd probably be reputation risk and unsafe, unsound, or, providing more transparency. Unfortunately, the FIRM Act passed through the Senate Banking Committee on a party line vote, and that was going to address reputation risk. So I don't know how much bipartisan support there is, except maybe something on more transparency for confidential supervisory information. Yeah. That might be, if I had to pick one that was likely to get bipartisan support, I guess that would be my pick. But hopefully, as things go on, as more information develops, hopefully we can arrive to some meaningful and broadly acceptable reforms.
I try to put myself in sincerely in the mind of a progressive sometime. And if I knew how Bank Secrecy Act suspicious activity reports worked and I were progressive, I wouldn't necessarily want ICE to have all this data about banking transactions that they could get from the Financial Crimes Enforcement Network. So we've seen before, I'm old enough to remember 25 years ago, the ACLU came out against expansion of Know Your Customer reports around 9/11. So I'm just hoping that at least raising the thresholds for how much you have to, which is in the FIRM Act, which is in the Tillis bill, about how much from I think at least from 10 to 30,000 about for currency transactions and others for suspicious activity report would get some vote, that we don't have, that people can agree that this is this information, first of all, isn't catching a lot of innocent people and can be misused and can be misused by either party to violate civil liberties of people. And Brian made the point that Blackmun and Powell were the in the Supreme Court case originally upholding the Bank Secrecy Act that said if this were lower than $10,000 there might be some privacy problems. Well, now it is with inflation adjusted. So we had the three liberals in dissent, moderates, saying that this should be upheld on these conditions, and then Law and Order conservatives, I think you might, who believe, you know, upheld it without reservation. I think given the Supreme Court scrutiny on third party doctrine and everything like that, as well as what's just some of the discussion, you might find a compromise there, or maybe even a surprise victory in the courts.
Something that I think has come out here is this kind of expansion of or this concept of political discrimination. Right. It seems even if it may be legal, like, I don't think any bank would be like, well, we're not banking conservatives. We're not banking, you know, progressives. Most of the time it doesn't matter. But if you're debanked, you can be like, I was debanked because I'm progressive or I'm conservative, and there isn't really. It's sort of then incumbent on the bank to like disprove that, which of course they can't because of CSI reasons that we discussed earlier. Is there a risk that in opening up or in trying to set rules around debanking that it could kind of make, put banks in this kind of position where they have to like prove or disprove why they make the decisions about what kind of customers they have or continue to have businesses, and what are the kind of risks that might accompany such a regime? Tabitha, you seem to be nodding. So
yeah, I mean, I think totally sympathetic and understand like the frustration of, you know, having an account closed and not being able to understand the reason why. You mentioned some of that secrecy it's not CSI. It's actually the SAR secrecy requirements that also are statutory. And it doesn't just prevent the bank from saying, you know, we filed a SAR, which again, the threshold for that is very low, but any information that indicates whether or not a SAR was filed is prohibited. You know, the bank is prohibited to disclose, and there are good reasons for it. We don't want people we don't want to interfere with law enforcement investigations, and we don't want to provide a roadmap to fraudsters to be able. And this will happen. You know, where people will see, oh well, this didn't work here. The account got closed. I'm going to go try something else. And if they're getting granular information about why the account was closed, that can just provide a roadmap for fraudsters to figure out how to circumvent, you know, anti-fraud systems. And we don't want that either. So there's good reasons why you want some, you know, some protections about information, you know, understand also the need for, you know, the ability to provide more information to customers who are, you know, understandably in a really frustrating situation. So open to those, you know, recommendations on how we can, you know, strike the right balance.
But I would note, you know, and I probably should have done this earlier, and I apologize for not doing it. The reason why we need to be concerned about political discrimination is not like, ooh, boo-hoo Republicans, boo-hoo Democrats. It's that our system relies upon the notion that individuals can engage in core political activity, speech, organization, et cetera. And we have examples of organizations that have lost their accounts with a bank or with a bank-owned, you know, product. And when they asked, they were either stonewalled. And there, you know, maybe that's a SAR, but maybe it's just the bank isn't required to say. Or what they get back is a citation saying, oh, you violated our terms of service, because if you look at this term, it says you can't use this product for hate, defamation, et cetera, et cetera. We know that terms like hate have been weaponized. They were weaponized against the late Charlie Kirk and his organization. And so when banks are taking away, you know, access to things, unfortunately, I am completely blanking on the political action committee that lost their account that was owned by one of the large banks, you know, payment system. They were going to have a rally starring Donald Trump Jr. and they lost their account. And what happened is when they asked why, they got that pushed back at them. And then after Missouri politicians pushed back on the bank came and said, oh, we're so sorry. You know, that was a mistake, but the event had to be canceled anyway. And so when we're talking about this, what we are talking about, or at least what I'm talking about, is concern about protecting that core speech, that core First Amendment freedom, and, you know, in a meaningful way. Otherwise, I mean, the legitimacy of our system just kind of falls apart.
John, we this need is to just end the secrecy. Ahead, we need to end the secrecy so people can find out, you know, why their account was closed. And, you know, if even if there's no governmental remedy, they can take it, you know, in the court of public opinion, having that information, and then the market pressure, like it does on other businesses, you know, will apply to that bank. Also, I think if you had, you know, where you change some of the secrecy laws, you would have things where banks could negotiate, could spell out in contracts with customers, you know, what are the procedures for account closing? What are these? And so people would, you know, there would be more of a marketplace as far as that and what the account security and terms of closure and ending the relationship are.
This is just occurring to me as we're talking, and maybe with 1 minute left in the discussion, it's the wrong time to freelance here. But doesn't that all kind of make the bank account as an artifact take on characteristics more of like a right than sort of a privilege? If you have a bank account, you have certain rights of not having that taken away, which seems to be not really be the framework, the legal framework that that bank accounts have now.
No, I, John, I don't think so. I think the better analogy is if we look at something like ECOA. You don't have a right to a credit card, but you have a right to not lose your credit card because of your race or your country of origin or whatever. And so here, you know, at least on this panel, and to my knowledge, on the sort of the Fair Access legislation that's floating around, nobody's saying thou shall issue an account. There are any number of reasons why a bank might not. But what we are saying, at least what I'm saying, is there are certain criteria that are so inappropriate, so damaging to higher values in society, so inconsistent with the reason why we protect and privilege banks, that you can't use that criteria to decide. So if you fail to pay your credit card for 2 months, you have no right to that credit card. But, you know, maybe if you want to use your bank account to pay for a lawful political rally, that should not be the criteria by which it is taken away.
And I agree that the terms and conditions, like John was saying, can be the circumstances around the account closure can be, you know, provided by contract. And also just want to note that, you know, banks, of course, are incentivized to keep accounts open and to serve as many customers as they possibly can. It is what they're in the business of doing. They expend extraordinary resources to market to customers, recruit and retain customers. So I think interests are aligned on that.
Well, John, by default, you get the last word.
Well, thank you for my, I'll give the last word that this has been, I've enjoyed this stirring debate with you and my fellow panelists, and my book, George Washington Entrepreneur, is in paperback. And yes, we, at the 200, I would agree. You don't have a right to a bank account, but the government should set rules so that banks, credit unions, and whoever wants to compete with your credit can, there is vibrant competition and choice and opportunity.
All right, I'll pass back to Sarah with that.
Thank you. On behalf of the Federalist Society, thank you so much to Mr. Berlau, Ms. Edgins, and Mr. Knight for speaking, and for Mr. Holtman for moderating. We're so grateful for your time and expertise on this important topic. Thank you to our audience for joining us. We really appreciate your participation. You can also stay up to date with other announcements and upcoming webinars on our website, fedsoc.org, or on all major social media platforms. Thank you once more for tuning in. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.